Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me as we prepare to take another look in the true crime rabbit hole. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast, Deathcast Pod, or Deathcast Podcast. You can find me on most social media platforms under those monikers. If you enjoy the show and like what I do and you'd like to help out, easiest thing you can do, go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, subscribe to the show, and share it on social media. It really does help a lot to get the show out there to other people, and for those of you who have done that, I greatly appreciate it. If you're interested in getting any of the official Deathcast merch, that's stickers and t-shirts, just click on the link in the show notes. And please don't forget to visit our sponsors. They're what is making it possible for me to continue doing this show and to hopefully make it better for you, the listeners. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, get yourself something to drink, find a nice comfy chair, sit back and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt. We have a special episode of the Deathcast this week. We are proud to be joined by retired Morrison County Sheriff's Office Sergeant Investigator Jeremy L. Lubertz, who is the author of the book Murder on Elm Street, A True Life Story, which will be coming out this fall. Jeremy, are you there?
I am, yes. Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Yourself?
Oh, pretty good. So yeah, my book will be coming out in September of 2023, this coming fall.
Let's just get right into it. Who is Jeremy L. Lubertz?
Well, I was a deputy sheriff for Morrison County for 28 years, and I was the department's lead investigator. I retired as sergeant. I was the lead investigator for 12 years.
I imagine you must have seen some pretty hectic cases. I would imagine too that they were homicides.
Yes, I investigated all the major felony cases in my county, including homicides, burglaries, sexual assaults, you name it, arsons, many cases. And in the 28 years that I worked, I never lost a case in court.
Wow, that is impressive. Now, I know we're going to be talking about one case specific today, but are there any other cases that you covered that anyone may have heard of?
Well, the last case I was working on before I retired was the Terry Brisk case.
Okay.
He was a deer hunter that was shot and killed in Morrison County. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Is Morrison County a fairly rural area?
Yes. Yep. We're located right smack dab, basically in the center of Minnesota. Fairly large size county. Yeah, a lot of area to cover.
Okay. Now, I was looking at the press release that you sent me, and this book is specifically about the Haley Kiefer and Nicholas Brady murder. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah.
So, what exactly happened with these two young people? I understand they're cousins.
That's correct. So, back in November 2012, on November 23rd to be exact, the day after Thanksgiving, I was at home enjoying time off with my family, and I get a call from one of our deputies, which is not uncommon. I get called all the time when I'm off duty for questions or if something major comes up to come in and work the case, assist the deputies, because there was only two of us investigators working for the county at the time. Mm-hmm. So as you can imagine, we stayed really busy. So Deputy David Sherping called me and told me that he had a William Anderson that called the office reporting that his neighbor, Byron Smith, had called him asking for assistance, looking for an attorney. And he said that Bill told Dave that Byron had been broken into and he might have shot somebody. Just seemed rather odd that Bill would be calling with some information like that. So I told Dave I'd get ready, come in, and assist him in this case. So what I did was drove to the office, met with a couple of my deputies, Dave in particular. We made a, being I'm the sergeant in the matter, I'm in charge of the deputies, so made a plan to go over to Byron Smith's residence to see what the heck was going on. Kind of an odd call. You know, it's not uncommon we get calls from people over-exaggerating things, but this one just seemed a little odd. Something was telling me I should follow up on this further, so that's why I did. So I came up with a plan for the three of us to go to his, drive to his residence, which is located just on the north, just into the county, on the north edge of Little Falls. So we, as we're driving down, just so happens Byron lives, his address dead ends on Elm Street. Kind of ironic.
Yes, it is. Yes.
There. Right, exactly. So as we're driving by, the complainant's residence, the guy that called it in, William Anderson, I see him walking down his driveway as he sees me slowly driving by heading towards Byron's place. So I stop, roll down my window, and he comes up and he talks to me. And I happen to know William Anderson. And I asked him, I said, hey, what can you tell me? Look, can you tell me any more information about this? And he, I said, did Byron tell you that he shot and killed somebody today or anything like that? He said, no, he didn't tell me that. Just that, I knew he was having problems with burglaries at his house, and he called asking for assistance looking for an attorney. I said, oh, okay. So I thanked him, continued down the road, went to, drove it down Byron's driveway, he had a rather long dirt driveway that leads up to his house, which was a brick-style rambler home. So Dave and I, Dave Sherping and I, get up to the house, exit our squad cars. I'm walking up towards the front door, right? Well, an older, I don't know Byron Smith, never met him before. So an older man in his mid-60s comes walking out of the house with his hands raised above his head. His hair's all messy. Looked like he's wearing clothes, a blue jean jacket and jeans. Looks like he slept in them. And comes walking out towards me. And I'm like, what the heck? What's going on here? You know, I mean, that's not common. It's very uncommon to have somebody come walking out of their house with their hands raised above their heads, you know, kind of a red flag there. So I go and ask him, so I confirmed it was Byron Smith who I was talking to. And I said, hey, I heard something might've happened at your house. Do you mind if we come in and I talk to you? And he said, sure. And he put his hands down and he invited us into his house. We walked in there. First thing he does, as soon as you get through the entrance door, there's a laundry room to the right. There's a kitchen to the left, a stairwell in front that leads down to the basement, and then a long hallway that leads down to the bedrooms and a living room. So Byron has us follow him down to his bedroom. So we walk down to his bedroom. The door's closed. He opens the door. This is wintertime, mind you. We just had 2 inches of snow that fell on the ground. He opens the door, and it's cold in that room. Here I see that there's a window in the bedroom that had been smashed. And it was obviously from somebody that was on the outside breaking the window because the glass was laying on the inside. Over. Byron tells me, somebody broke into my residence yesterday, and I've had it happen before. So he's telling us about this burglary that happened at his place. So I'm starting to think now, man, this is going to be just a regular, your standard burglary investigation, right? So he tells us, he's going into this spiel about how the window was broke and how he's missed other things in the past. And then finishes the story. We're walking back towards the kitchen area, and he goes, yeah, there's something I need to show you in the basement. I'm like, okay. He starts walking down the steps, and I'm right behind him walking down. And as I'm walking down the stairs, I see a speck of blood on the wall. And I'm like, okay, that's a little interesting. And as I'm continuing down the steps, I see a spot of blood on the rug at the bottom of the stairs. Well, I'm like, all right, now, big red flags here. You know, the hairs on the back of my neck are starting to stand up now. I turn back towards my partner, Dave, one of the deputies there, and I said, hey, turn your recorder on. So we get down to the bottom of the steps. Byron starts telling me that, I was sitting in my downstairs chair here when my house was broken into. And I said, oh, okay. And looking at the chair, it's as soon as you get to the bottom of the steps, he's got a couple bookcases, tall bookcases set up, and this chair set up right in the center. And it's very odd. You know, I've never seen anybody plan on doing something like that before. To me, it looked like he was trying to hide from anybody that, because yeah, there was a picture window behind there from anybody made trying to look from the outside in. Nobody could see him in that chair unless you came directly down the steps. And you wouldn't see him until you got to the bottom. So I also noticed a bottle of water and some energy bars sitting next to the chair. It looked like he had been planning on sitting there for a while, really. So just an odd thing I noted, and there was a pair of tennis shoes under the chair. Nike brand, like skater style tennis shoes, you know, like your typical teenager would wear. So he's telling us about his previous break-in and that, and all of a sudden he tells me, yeah, and when they broke into my house, the male party came walking down my steps, and I shot him. Excuse me, what? You did what? I shot
him. That's something you'd think that they would, you know, they'd call
think that would be the first thing they tell you, but no, not this guy. It's like, wow. And I shot him. And he goes, he came tumbling down as he was walking down the steps. I had my mini 14 rifle loaded sitting next to me in the basement when I was sitting in my chair reading. And he tumbled down to the bottom of the steps and he's laying there and I want him dead. He goes, I took my gun and I shot again and I killed him. And I'm sitting there like, wow, this is like a holy shit moment. You know, it's like, what the heck? I said, so what happened then? And I'm not seeing, you know, when he's telling me this, I'm looking around on the floor and I'm not seeing any pool of blood, brain matter, you know, anything like that. I'm like, what the heck's going on? Just a small spot of blood on the rug.
Yeah, and the spot that's in the stairwell.
Exactly. Yeah, and the little speck that's in the stairwell. So he goes, yeah, well, I had a tarp laying over by my fireplace. So just a little ways from me, I grabbed the tarp. I wrapped his body up in the tarp because there was all this blood and I didn't want to soak it into my carpet. So then I took and I drug the body off into my back office storage room in the basement here. I said, okay. And he goes, and then somebody else came in. I'm like, oh, there's a second party. He goes, mm-hmm. Yep. And I heard her after I shot and killed him, drug his body back here. The blood was pounding in my ears. I just needed to calm down. I walked back in here. I sat back in my chair. And I'm sitting here just trying to relax, trying to collect myself. And then I hear more footsteps upstairs, he tells me. And I can hear the footsteps coming down the hallway and gets to the top of the steps and starts coming down again. And I said, well, how long was there a break in between or what's going on? Was this immediate? He goes, yeah, it was about... Because there was like a 5-10 minute break in between, and then I heard these other footsteps. So the footsteps start coming down the stairs, and he goes, I shot again. I had my mini 14 rifle, and I shot him. I shot again, and she went tumbling down to the bottom of the steps. I said, this was a female party now? He goes, yep. And she's laying wounded at the bottom of the steps. I go to shoot her again, and the gun jams. It just goes click, he tells me. He goes, well, then she starts laughing at me. I said, she's laughing at you. I said, isn't she hurt? Yeah, she's hurt at the bottom of the stairs, but she starts laughing at me. And he goes, well, that was a red button. He goes, that's just a red button for me. You know, it just made me more upset. So I just grabbed my pistol I had on my side and I shot her and shot her. I'm like, where'd you shoot her? I shot her in the chest multiple times.
We have to take a break here to pay the electric bill. We will be back for more of this fascinating story in just a moment. Face it, shaker bottles suck. Your protein shake always comes out clumpy and you look like an idiot using the thing. That's why I decided to ditch my shaker bottle for good and get myself a BlendJet 2 portable blender. It makes perfectly blended protein shakes in just 20 seconds. BlendJet 2 is portable, so you can blend up a smoothie at work, a protein shake at the gym, or even a margarita on the beach. It's small enough to fit in a cup holder, but powerful enough to blast through tough ingredients like ice and frozen fruit with ease. BlendJet 2 is whisper quiet, so you can make your morning smoothie without waking up the whole house. And it lasts for 15 plus blends and recharges quickly via a USB-C cord. Best of all, BlendJet 2 cleans itself. Just blend water and a drop of soap and you're good to go. So what are you waiting for? Go to BlendJet.com and grab yours today. And be sure to use the promo code DECASTPOD to get 12% off your order and free 2-day shipping. No other portable blender on the market comes close to the quality, power, and innovation of the BlendJet 2. They guarantee you'll love it or your money back. Blend anytime, anywhere with the BlendJet 2 portable blender. Go to blendjet.com and use the code DECASTPOD to get 12% off your order and free 2-day shipping. Shop today and get the best deal ever. Again, that's blendjet.com and use promo code DECASTPOD at checkout. That's capital D, capital C, AST, capital POD at checkout to get 12% off and free 2-day shipping.
After that, I grabbed a body, I drug her back into my office workroom area, and later next to the boy. Okay. And after I did that, she's still breathing, he tells me. So he goes, I can't stand to see any animals or people suffer. So I gave her a good clean finishing shot. And he's going right here. He's telling me he's got his hand in the shape of a gun, and he's got like the barrel pointed underneath his chin. He goes, right here is where I shot her.
What are you thinking as he's telling you all this? I can't imagine this is the type of call you've ever had before.
This is something I have never encountered before in my life. And what I was thinking was, how can this be real? You know, it was such a shock to hear what he's telling me. It's like, until I had physical proof, it was hard to believe. I said, where are these bodies now? Because I'm not seeing anything. If you shot somebody at the bottom of your steps, I should be seeing them. They should be just laying there, right? And he goes, no, they're back here. Follow me. He brings us back into this separate room from the basement, right off from the stairwell. And then there's another room behind this other one, and there's a door closed. He goes, the bodies are behind this door. So I walk back there. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself, please, God, don't let there be any bodies back here. This is going to be one big mess. I opened the door and looked, and there was the body. There were the bodies of two young teenagers, the two cousins, a young boy and a young female. We later identified the male party to be Nicholas Brady, who was 17 years old, and his cousin, the female party, who was 18 years old, Haley Kiefer. Now, from that point, it's like, wow, I had to make a quick decision. You know, what am I going to do with this? With the story he just told me, you know, my first thought was people have the right to protect themselves in their own homes. So he had a legal right at some point to use force to be able to protect himself. So he had the right to actually shoot somebody that breaks into your home. You have the right to do that. But I'm thinking, from what his story he just told me, to me, it felt like it was an execution. It felt like it was more, far beyond just protecting yourself. It felt to me like this was a revenge thing.
That's what it sounds like. It's like it was premeditated, or, you know, with
exactly
a full-on homicide.
Yes, that's the way it felt to me. And this is why I told him, I looked at him, I said, Byron, you know, because of what you told me, because of what happened here today, I have to place you under arrest. I said, so I'm placing you under arrest. And he looks at me, he goes, no, he goes, I understand, you're just doing your job. He was very matter of fact about everything when I talked to him, which was rather interesting too.
Yeah, it sounds like he was more calm than most individuals who would experience something like this would be.
Exactly. He was. Just my impression of Byron was, he was, I don't know, kind of an odd character, you might say. Just my opinion. Nice enough gentleman, but just a little on the odd side. He was single. He was never married. Didn't live with anybody, lived by himself. And he had worked for the Department of Homeland Security, the State Department, installing security systems in embassies. Mm-hmm. Did a lot of that overseas too. So I placed him under arrest and contact my sheriff. We make plans to bring Byron to the sheriff's office. And in the meantime, I contacted the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, the BCA. They are a state agency that assists other agencies around the state with homicide investigations in particular. And they've helped me on a lot of different cases They helped process, they helped to collect the evidence at the scenes and to process the scenes, because they have the labs and the technicians to be able to test the DNA, test the projectiles from the guns, test the guns, you know, for to see if the bullets were from fired from the particular guns. So that's why we used it. They're a great resource for us.
Yeah, they're similar to the BCI in Georgia.
Sure. I think every state has basically a state agency that assists your local police departments and your sheriff's offices. So, yeah. So from there, we haul Byron back to the sheriff's office. Well, the best piece of evidence you could ever get in a case is a statement, is a confession from somebody, right?
Yes.
So I get him back there, and the hardest thing to ever get that I've come to realize too is actually getting a confession from somebody. Everybody watches TV. Everybody watches, you know, has seen the Miranda warning legal rights written to me, read to people, you know. You have the right to remain silent, you know, and once they hear that, they're like, nope, I'm not talking. I have the right to an attorney. Forget it. I'm not going to talk to you. No, I'll talk to my, I need to talk to an attorney first before I give a statement to law enforcement. So that was always the biggest hurdle to try to get beyond. Can it be done? Absolutely. I've done it so many times. I've been actually very successful at getting beyond, getting suspects to get beyond that point, get beyond the Miranda warning to actually talk to you and give you a statement, give you a confession. So, and there's a knack, there's a trick to doing it. And it's almost, it's basically for investigators, I call it a learned art form, because it's not something that can per se, it can't be taught to you. It's something that has to be learned. And yes, the more you do it, the better you get at it. College and schools and that, they can teach you proper procedure on how to do it, but it can never take the place of experience. The more times you do it, the better you get at it. So, and then, when we got him back to the office, then I had to convince the sheriff, my sheriff at the time, Michael Wetzel, I had to convince him to let me do it, let me do the statement with him. I built up a heck of a rapport with Byron at his house. And I felt that if he was going to talk to anybody, I felt it was going to be me because of that rapport that I built up with him. Anytime I deal with somebody, I kill them with kindness. Why? Because I want to show, and that's just the way I am anyway. I treat people the way I'd want to be treated, and I don't care. I don't care what kind of crime they commit. I'm going to treat you the way I believe, you know, I would want to be treated in your shoes. And it's out of respect for people. So, yeah. And I finally get Mikkel to, Sheriff Wetzel, to agree to allow me to do the statement with Byron. I was glad, because I haven't, at this point, I haven't interviewed any murder suspects yet in my career. Interviewed everything else. I've actually even interviewed somebody that was accused and tried and convicted for an attempted murder case. I've done that. But yeah, this one. And so then once I get the approval to do that from Mikkel, then I go into the interview room, and I'm trying to get the recorder. We have a one interview room at the time in our office. We've got a video recorder, and I also do use a backup digital audio handheld recorder, right?
Okay.
So I'm trying to set up the video recorder. It's an older one, and it downloads onto a CD, right? I'm trying to set that up. Somebody turned the monitor off in that room. I can't get it to work. Got to be kidding me. One of the biggest cases, you know, ever, that came along, especially in Morrison County or even in Minnesota. And I can't get the video recorder to work. I had no choice but to go in and just use my handheld digital recorder to record the statement with them. Is that good? Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's plenty good enough, but it's always nice to have a video recording to show, you know, the suspect's reaction of when he's telling you something, what it looks like, what they're saying. It's just more of a tool to show to a jury his reactions on his answers to you. You know, it helps. But so I used what I had, went in there, and I read Byron his Miranda warning legal rights. And lo and behold, from the way I felt, from the way I treated him at the scene, up until the point I read him his Miranda rights, he agrees to talk to me without an attorney present. That's the biggest hurdle to ever try to get over when you're trying to get a statement from somebody. I get over that hurdle. And what I obtained from him was an hour-long statement. Roughly an
hour-long statement. Yeah, I was just going to say, that's what it sounds like you were leading to.
Oh, yes.
Retired San Francisco homicide inspector Frank Falzone a couple of months ago. Mm-hmm. We were talking about the Harvey Milk murder.
Sure.
And he said it was similar to what you're describing. It wasn't a questioning. It was a statement when he talked to Dan White. He just started talking and would not stop.
Yes. And that's what happened with me and Byron too. Byron wanted to tell his story. He mm-hmm. felt that he felt like he was being picked on prior to this incident. And what we ultimately discovered was, let me finish with the statement thing. So Byron gives me an hour-long statement and I ended up actually taking three separate statements from Byron, not just one. So the first statement was the initial one with him, and I get his full story in regards to what happened there. Well, then I take another, probably about another 20-minute statement after that from him, just to cinch up some information as far as the guns, you know, yes. What happened with the guns. And he reported a previous burglary at his house that, incidentally, my identical twin brother, who's a deputy at the sheriff's office also that I work with, he's the one that handled the investigation for that burglary case that was reported back in October, the month before this incident happened. You know, how ironic is it that I'm working with my identical twin brother at the same sheriff's office? It's actually a pretty, it's kind of pretty cool. It is. And it works so well. We work so well together.
Going to ask, you know, you must have had times where you decided to kind of mess with a perp that you're trying to get information out.
Oh, you know, it was actually a headache for us.
Yeah.
So many times people would be calling, asking, they'd call looking to speak with Deputy Lubbers. And my dispatcher would just shake their head. You're like, excuse me. Okay. And they start describing what Deputy Lubbers looked like. And she's like, this isn't going to help. You know, I mean, they're twins. They look the same. You got to give me something different. So, yeah, it was confusing as heck for the community when we worked. But we worked together so good that we were a great crime busting duo. So, oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Getting back to the story, when I finished my first statement with Byron, when we got him back to the office, I still had no idea who the teenagers were that were in his house. Byron had no idea who it was. He thought that the female party was his neighbor, Ashley Williams.
Okay.
He hated the Williams family. And you could tell that he was very, very blunt about that. Him and Bill Anderson, the Williams family was right in between Anderson's residence and Smith's residence. And you had Anderson and Smith that both hated the Williams family. They did not get along. So Byron kept blaming the young girl, Ashley, that was living at the house for his burglaries. And that's who he thought the female was that did his burglary. He was adamant and even told me this in his statement. He thought for sure it was Ashley Williams. Turns out it wasn't.
Well, I'm sure you
had to Ashley Williams had nothing to do with it. What's that?
I'm sure you had to run all of that info down in between the statements of checking to see if this young girl is actually, in fact, missing.
Well, how we found out is, so that was one of the dilemmas too, after I got done with the first statement from Byron. I had to identify who these teenagers were because right now we have no clue. Mm-hmm. While I'm talking with the BCA and with Sheriff Wetzel about that, we get a phone call at the sheriff's office from two parents saying that their teenage son and daughter, Brady, teenage cousins, Nicholas Brady and Haley Kuiper, didn't show up for Thanksgiving yesterday. And they can't get them on their cell phones. They haven't heard from them and they're worried. And so they were calling them in as missing people. So
this is that raising red flags with you guys? Are you thinking this?
Absolutely.
Okay.
No, I knew right away. Once we got that call, once I heard that, I knew right away that it was connected because mm-hmm. they described what they look like in that. And it's like, yes, these are the two dead kids that are in Byron Smith's basement. So that was actually helpful that we were able to get that call and at least have an idea who the victims are down in the basement there. So then from there, the BCI ended up having to type 5 separate search warrants, 6 in total search warrants. I had to get the first one done right away for Byron's house because I had the BCA sitting on it so we could start getting it processed. And during that time, I also get a call. We also got a call from one of our local state patrol officers, Carla and Brian Bierce. Brian tells us, yeah, I heard you guys are working on a murder case over there. I just got to tell you about the suspicious vehicle that we had that was parked in front of our residence yesterday. Just so happens, the Bierces only live a quarter mile away to the north of where Byron was on a dead end cul-de-sac. Well, Brian reports that, yeah, there's this silver in color Chevy S10 pickup. Somebody parked it in front of my house and the tires are actually on my lawn. He goes, I have no idea who did it. They parked it here yesterday. So I send one of our deputies over there to check it out, meet with Brian. He runs the license plate on the vehicle, comes back to Byron Smith. So here we find out that Byron had parked that vehicle a quarter mile away from his residence on Thanksgiving Day, approximately an hour before his house was broken into.
Absolutely fascinating stuff, and we'll get back to this in just one moment.
I'm on the road a lot, and it's really hard to stay properly hydrated on the road. There's so many choices between water and sports drinks, many of them filled with sugars and other chemicals that leave you feeling run down afterwards. But what if I told you there is a better solution? Liquid 4 is the category-winning hydration brand fueling your well-being, and their hydration multiplier is the one product you're missing in your daily routine. In just one stick, you get 5 essential vitamins and 2 times faster hydration than water alone. Use it first thing in the morning, before a workout, when you feel run down, after a long night out, and on a long flight. One of the things I like best about the Liquid 4 Hydration Multiplier is their delicious flavor options, such as sea berry, strawberry lemonade, Concord grape, lemon lime, pina colada, or my personal favorite, watermelon. But Liquid 4 doesn't just taste good, it's good for you. It contains 5 essential vitamins, B3, B5, B6, B12, and vitamin C. And it has 3 times the electrolytes of traditional sport drinks. But best of all, Liquid 4 is non-GMO and free from gluten, dairy, and soy, which means that anybody can enjoy it, regardless of their dietary restrictions. And now, just for listeners of my show, you can get 20% off when you go to liquidiv.com and use code DECASTPOD at checkout. That's 20% off anything you order when you shop Better Hydration today using promo code DECASTPOD. So go to liquid4, that's IV.com, and use promo code capital D, capital C, AST, capital POD at checkout to get 20% off your order. Liquid 4 Hydration. It's time to take your hydration needs to the next level.
Comra Killer, Gay Porn, Murder, and the Manhunt to Bring the Killers to Justice by Andrew E. Stoner and Peter A. Conway is the first and most detailed account of the gay porn murder that shocked a nation. Cobra Killer, featured on NBC's Snapped Killer Couples, pulls back the glitzy veil of the gay porn industry to expose a story of deceit, greed, and the ultimate betrayal. Cobra Killer, Gay Porn, Murder, and the Manhunt to Bring the Killers to Justice tells the story of online gay porn entrepreneur Brian Kosis, whose brutal near-decapitation on a Wednesday in early 2007 sent shockwaves through the small Pennsylvania town where he ran his porn empire. The basis for the Christian Slater film King Cobra, Cobra Killer has been called an addictive page-turner that you won't want to put down, by the San Diego LGBT Weekly and a grisly, gripping documentary account of the 2007 murder by Passport Magazine, Cobra Killer, Gay Porn, Murder, and the Manhunt to Bring the Killers to Justice by Andrew E. Stoner and Peter A. Conway, available on Amazon in paperback and ebook, or at bookstores nationwide.
It was discovered that he parked it away, so making it look like he wasn't home. He was setting a trap for somebody. He had no clue who was going to break into his house or when, but he was setting a trap to try to catch who had ever broken into his house before, because he wanted his revenge on these people. The way he had his chair set up in the basement, the way he had the bottle of water, the energy bar sitting down there, he unscrewed the light bulbs from the ceiling in the basement. He basically was a deer hunter in his stand, sitting waiting for his prey to come in. That's what we ultimately determined and came up with there.
Was this all information he was giving you freely during the various statements he was giving, or?
No, absolutely not. This is all information that we're getting calls on. We're putting pieces of the puzzles together. This is stuff that I can go back on and ask him questions on later. This is not stuff that he was giving us freely. This is stuff that we're discovering. And the case just basically kept rolling along, snowballing from there, just kept rolling. At one point, I go back to the house after executing some of these search warrants. Excuse me. And I'm talking with the BCA agents, and we're getting close to being done at Byron's house. We find he has a video surveillance recording system in the basement, except we can't get into it. Except the BCA guys have no idea how to view it, how to record it, you know, because it's like a digital analog type system.
Okay.
And it's password protected. This is why I had to go back for a third time and take a third statement from Byron to see if I can get the password information so that we can get that surveillance recording. There were four cameras set up around his house, which makes sense being he was a surveillance, you know, expert installing them in embassies and that. He had four cameras set up on the outside of the house, but he had nothing set up on the inside. So we had recording evidence that we could get from at least the activity that was happening outside the house. And I was able to go back for a third time, meet with Byron after he had talked with an attorney this time when he was at the jail, and still got him to give a third statement without his attorney present. So I was very fortunate on that end. In that third statement, I was able to get the password for the surveillance system. But I was also able to ask him about why he parked his truck a quarter mile away from his house. And he told me, oh, I just moved it over there because I was planning on cleaning out the garage and that. I said, Byron, that don't make sense to me. No. Why would you park it up your house a quarter mile away down a dead end cul-de-sac because you're going to clean your house? That don't even make sense. He goes, well, his answer to me was, well, they're not getting burglarized over there. I'm the one that's getting burglarized.
No, it's sounding like he's starting to realize that this isn't just a simple, they came into my house, I protected my property, I might be in real trouble here situation.
Exactly. Byron was the type, when I took a statement from him, when I was talking, he told me how did he word it again? He said this was like a hot spot for me when he was talking about when he shot Haley. Because he told me, he goes, she looked at me and she laughed at me. And he goes, now that's kind of a hot spot for anybody. He goes, I just took my gun and shot her in the chest until she was dead. And it's like, whoa, no, that's not something typical that somebody would do. Byron told me he had been picked on when he was growing up.
Yeah.
It seemed like he had a lot of issues as far as people ganging up on. He told me too. He's been ganged up before in the past, and it doesn't sit well with him at all.
That
was a big part of it here too.
It sounded like he's got some severe, you know, psychological issues, like, you know, psychopathic tendencies.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, a lot of red flags there, and you could clearly see that. I had asked Byron too, in particular, when I've taken a statement, were you ever involved in a war? He was in the military. In fact, he had some of his military medals that were stolen from his previous burglary from his house. And I asked him, I said, did you ever have to shoot anybody? No, he never had to shoot anybody. So I thought, you know, maybe if he did, maybe this would kind of be a reason why he took the action that he did. But no, yeah. He didn't have to shoot anybody. In fact, I don't, from my best recollection, I don't think he was boots on the ground, you know, having to walk through a jungle or anything like that. I do know from him telling me he did not have to shoot anybody. So previously. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Before the BCA finished up with the search warrant at the house, I went back there and I was helping finish up, look around. I always like to take a second look around in all my cases when anybody even helps me to make sure that everything was gone through. So many times I've come across where investigators have missed stuff. I have missed stuff too, helping other people on search warrants. Things get missed all the time. That's why it's always been my policy to take a second look around before you leave, before you're mm-hmm. done. So I'm taking a second look around in the basement. Well, in his office work area where the bodies were found, there's a desk back there. And sitting on top of the desk, I find a digital recorder, handheld recorder. Audio one, you know. I pick it up, yes. I turn it on, battery's dead. It's like, oh, okay. Looks like it's been sitting here a while. Looks like it's old, hasn't been used. But I found it kind of interesting. So I showed it to Chad Musias. He was Agent Chad Musias. He was the lead BCA agent assisting us. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I saw that same type of recorder sitting in the bookshelf above his reading chair where he was sitting. I said, really? Can you show that to me? He shows it to me. It's the same brand, same make and model, everything, you know. He goes, I said, does it work? He turned it on. He goes, no, the batteries are dead on this too. Looks like it's been sitting there for a while. I told Chad, I want both of these taken and I want them analyzed just to see if there's anything on, you know. I said, he goes, the batteries are dead. And he goes, they've been sitting there for a while. He goes, no, I'm not going to take these. It'd be a waste of time. I told Chad, he told me he worked for an embassy and that installing surveillance systems and that. I have a strong feeling that there might be something on these. I just take them and please analyze them for me. Check them for me. Well, no, we're not going to take them. It's just a waste of our time to do it. I finally got real adamant with them. I said, you either take these and have them analyzed like I'm asking you to do. They're there to assist us.
Yes.
They don't come and take over investigation. The investigation in the case is the sheriff's office. It's my case. Mm-hmm. We're the lead on it. They're supposed to be there to assist us on it. So I'm real adamant with him, and I finally, reluctantly, he agrees to take the recorders and have them checked. So then from there, as time goes on, here to find out that the digital recorder that was sitting in the bookcase and the bookshelf above his reading chair where he had been sitting basically in his deer stand waiting for these people to come in was the holy grail piece of evidence that we found in the case. And the reason it was is it had everything on it. It recorded monologue from him talking prior to anybody breaking into his house. And then you can hear the break-in actually happen, the window shattering upstairs in his bedroom, the footsteps coming down the hallway. From there, we knew the boy was the first one to come in. And we heard him walking down the hallway, and the footsteps are getting closer, gets to the top of the stairs, starts walking down the steps. And as the footsteps are going down, we hear, boom, you know, this loud shot. And you can hear him tumble down to the bottom of the steps. It's almost like watching it in real life. It was so good. It was so clear. Mm-hmm. Just a short time later, you can hear a final shot. You hear him make a groaning noise, the male party, which was actually Nicholas Brady that was shot. Byron does a final shot and says something like, you're dead. Just real cruel.
Yeah, it sounds like
all of a sudden,
sounds like there's an extreme coldness to this guy.
There is, yes. There was a very very extreme coldness to him when it came to defending himself.
Yeah.
Or, you know, and then a short time later, you can hear the rustling of the tarp. He's wrapped. You can hear him wrapping Brady's body in the tarp and then dragging it away from the bottom of the steps and placing it in the back office room. Well, then he comes walking out. He's huffing and puffing. You can hear him. You know, he physically exerted himself. And as he's walking back towards where I can hear him getting closer to the recorder, he sits back in his chair and he's reloading his gun because I can hear the bullets sliding into the Mini 14 rifle. And about 11 minutes pass in the recording. And then all of a sudden you hear more footsteps upstairs. So he had 11 minutes in that time to call law enforcement to report what was going on. It took me 5 minutes to get from the sheriff's office to his house when I responded over there to follow up on this case. So he had ample time to call. Even prior to the first break-in with Brady, he had heard footsteps upstairs on his deck, people trying the doors and that, like they were going to break in. He told me this in his statement. He had ample time to call. He had a phone sitting downstairs, a landline phone, near his reading chair. And he never called law enforcement to report any of this. And my assumption is because he wanted his revenge. He didn't want to call law enforcement. He wanted his revenge. He was going to take care of this break-in problem on his own.
Do you think he made the recordings as sort of, you know, a trophy, so to speak, so he could relive it?
You know, I think that's very possible, because the reason I think that too is he didn't tell me about these recordings. I when I took his statements from him, he never mentioned the digital auto recorder at all. We just got extremely lucky that we found it and that I was able to get him analyzed. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, we could have very easily missed it. It was basically just an extreme lucky break for us on our end of the matter. And that's one of the key pieces of evidence, too, that helped the juries convict him, or the juror members convict him in this case. They said that after the trial was over. One of the big hot topics in this case, so to speak, for the news media. Now, this case made national news. And mm-hmm. why did it make national news? Because of what's called the Castle Doctrine Law. You ever heard yes. of the Castle Doctrine Law? It basically states that a person is the king of their castle, you know? Mm-hmm. It's their domain. They're not legally obligated to have to retreat from your own residence. They have the right to protect their home. They have the right to use deadly force to protect their home. Minnesota does not have the Castle Doctrine Law. What Minnesota has is the Stand Your Ground Law, which is yes. very similar to the Castle Doctrine Law. But the difference is you don't have, in Minnesota, you do not have the legal right to execute somebody. I believe that's the same with the Castle Doctrine Law also. It's not meant to protect people from executing somebody that breaks into your home. You have the right to protect yourself and your family and anybody else. You have the legal right to shoot them. You don't have the right, after they're wounded, to execute them. What Byron's obligation was is after he shot Nick and after he shot Haley was to render aid, call right away, law enforcement, render aid to the wounded, but not to execute him like he did, especially with the female, especially with Haley.
Yeah.
It was blatant, very, very, you know, matter of fact to me after he told me I drug the body back into the office room later next to the boy. She's still breathing. I noticed she's still breathing. I took my gun and gave her a good, clean finishing shot. Well, if that is an execution style, I don't know what is.
Oh, yeah. I read up on the case somewhat. He delivered a coup de grace right up underneath her chin.
Absolutely.
That's not defending your home anymore. You are intentionally taking their lives.
Exactly. And then one of the other things too is what we found also to help on that digital audio recording, he's talking, he's given a monologue prior to the kids breaking in of what he's going to do if somebody would break into his house. And he and he's gonna shoot and kill them. He was acting like he was talking to his brother Bruce, saying, "Yeah, Bruce, there's been a major development here. I need you to come to the house, park away from the house and walk in." And you know, he's doing this monologue about this. He's also acting like he's calling an attorney's office, saying, "Yeah, I need to speak to an attorney. It's an important matter." He's monologuing what he's going to do if he had to kill somebody.
And yes, after the fact.
Yeah, well, that he was monologuing before the fact. Well, yeah. Okay, yes. Let me correct that. Yes, he was monologuing what he was going to do if something happened. So, yes, after the fact, absolutely. And then not only did he do that prior to the shooting, then we listened to the whole shooting, and when it's done, he's doing it again. And he does it for hours. He's monologuing, you know. And it was great evidence for us to prove what, you know, his intent in this case. This is what makes this case so interesting, too, is it's very rare that you ever can determine a person's state of mind, a suspect's state of mind, who's involved in a murder case, right? Mm-hmm. It's hard to prove. Well, we'll tell you what it is. Listen to it. He told us. It's all recorded. Very rare piece of evidence to ever find in a murder case. So,
well, yeah, it's
fortunate.
Just from the outside, it sounds beyond premeditated.
Yes, yes. And that's how we felt. And this is why Byron was arrested and charged in the matter for murder, you know. But the news media, they made a huge drama of this case, and it went national. Why? Because, like I was saying before, of the Castle Doctrine Law. They were trying to say that, you know, and the media, a lot of times in my experiences, they're all about drama.
Of course, because yes, drama yes. and blood sells.
Well, exactly. Yes, it's all about that. And so they were really hyping up the Castle Doctrine Law. And what that did was it really made a lot of permit to carry and conceal to carry gun rights people mad, extremely mad, because everybody's thinking, you know, well, what the heck? They're trying to see, by arresting Byron, they're trying to say that we can't even own guns anymore, or that we can't even protect ourselves in our homes anymore by shooting somebody that's breaking in. This is, you know, this is a bunch of bullshit. No way. We do have the right to protect ourselves. And they were mad about it.
Oh,
but that wasn't the case in this matter. That wasn't actually, yeah, this is how it got so twisted and turned around is with the media, the way they were putting it out is they're making it look like we were trying to take people's rights away from them.
Well, no,
it's far from the truth. Very far from the truth. This case was not about taking people's rights or guns away from them. What this case was about is the actions of one man that he decided to do. It had nothing to do with taking people's guns away from them. But see, that's what people thought after the way the media had put it out in that and the, expressing the Castle Doctrine Law and stuff like that. Oh, it had people worked up. How do I know this? I was getting threats from people calling the sheriff's office because my name got out there because I was the lead investigator in the case. I had people calling me from all over the country, from different states, from people from, you know, in Minnesota, just everywhere. Madden.
That's a smart thing to do. Let's threaten a sheriff's deputy.
Isn't it? So that's what I had to deal with. Well, I was married at the time, right? Mm-hmm. They're even harassing my wife and harassing my family because of what, because I was the arresting officer in this. This is something that law enforcement officers, you know, in particular me, had to deal with in this case. And it got to be relentless. They started a coalition. People in Morrison County in Little Falls started a coalition called the Byron Smith Coalition Fund to raise money for Byron Smith's defense. Well, they had that meeting at the VFW in Little Falls, is where they would have their nightly meetings.
Yeah.
They got done. They gave their address. They gave my address and my brother's address. We just so happened to live right next door to each other. We had houses right next door to each other in Little Falls. And they gave our address out to the people that were coming to those meetings. And every time they got done, there was a parade of cars past our house every single time. was constant harassment.
They're lucky that nobody did anything, or they'd be up on charges.
Oh, I know. It was just constant harassment, constant, never ending. Well, if you can about imagine if you're married and you're an investigator, what your wife was thinking about all this.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
I can deal with it. You know, this is what I signed on for. She mm-hmm. didn't. She didn't sign on for this. And I had a 9-year-old daughter at home at the time. My wife was scared for my daughter. And frankly, I was getting concerned because of what was all going on. We caught a private investigator sitting in the alley near our house watching us because we found out the defense had hired a private investigator and why they were watching us, the deputies and the investigator in the case is beyond me. I don't know what they were hoping to get out of that.
I imagine that they didn't give the PI the facts of the case, because any PI worth his salt would have looked at this and said, there's nothing to get this guy on. This is media hype because they left out facts and got everyone worked up.
Well, sure. You know what they were looking to, in my opinion, what they were looking to do, the defense was looking to do is try to catch any dirt on the officers, my brother and me, per se, in this matter, mm-hmm. to use against us during Byron's jury trial. It's like, yeah. It's
that's foolish. A typical tactic is to, you know, discredit a witness.
Exactly. Exactly. That's what they were looking to do, is discredit my brother and I in this case. So, but did it work? No, it was a waste of time for them. But still, the acts alone, my wife saw all this. It's harassment on my family that just continued and weighed heavily, not only on her, but on me too, because I had to deal with the fact that she has to suffer for this, and it's not sitting well. And it didn't.
No, and I'm sure it was
basically, this case ended up wrecking my life. My book goes into detail of how it wrecked my life. Yes. And so I don't want to give the book away. You know, I don't want to give the storyline away, but that is a big part of my book, is how this case affected my life. Because a lot of people, you know, the media in particular, the movies that they kind of hype up, they make it look like it's such a great job being an investigator. And I love it, don't get me wrong, but it's not all, you know, sunshine and roses every day either. In fact, it's far from the truth. It's far from that. It's the amount of harassment I took in this case actually wrecked my life.
It changed it
forever.
In this show is that, you know, there are other victims other than murder victims in a crime like this, from surviving relatives and friends to even officers whose lives are irreparably changed after that.
And that's exactly right. Yes. And that's what happened to me in this case is my life was changed forever because of it. You know,
that's, you know, I can imagine. I mean, like I said, I've talked to numerous other members of law enforcement, mostly retired, and they've told me stuff. And it's unfortunate that other journalists, you know, they act and report without thinking of consequences. If I report this way, how is it going to affect everybody else? They just want to get it out there so they can get a payday and get their name in print.
You know, that I, from what I saw with the news media in this case, I mean, I would have to agree with that. Yeah.
Well, that's, you know, there's ethics in journalism, or supposed to be. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, a lot of these bigger journalistic news agencies, they don't follow them. And I mean, it's obvious from hearing you talk, they didn't follow any sort of ethics. They just wanted to get a paycheck. And, you know, whatever happens to the people left behind, oh, well.
A lot of truth to that. I mean, was some of this news media, intentional, intending to wreck my life? No, I don't believe that. But unintentionally, it did. So do I blame the media for my life being wrecked in this case? Absolutely not. No. But I do blame Byron.
Yeah.
Absolutely, because his actions and everything and what he did absolutely had a huge effect on me. So not only did Nick and Haley lose their lives because of what Byron did, the investigating officer, the investigator, me, myself, I lost my life because of it too, when the case finally was over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and That's something people, you know, just for my listeners, that's something people need to remember when they're looking into these kinds of things and even reaching out to officers who were involved in a case or survivors, that you don't know how a case affected somebody. And I say that because I have a good size audience and they'll just reach out to a family member or somebody was in law enforcement that was traumatized by something with a case, not realizing that this is a touchy subject.
Oh, absolutely. And Ian, too, I mean, the Nick Brady and Haley Kuiper's faces are burned into my memory for the rest of my life.
I can imagine.
Their bodies, when I had to look at their bodies all shot, riddled with bullets, and the gross scene that I saw, that is something I will never forget. Something that carries with you for the rest of your life. And that's just one case. It's not mm-hmm. multiple other cases that officers go through and see on a daily basis, you know. It's almost working in a crime. It's almost working as an officer a lot of times is like being in a war, except it's a war that goes on your whole career. It's not a war that you're over there for, let's say, a few months, or you're over in another country fighting for you know, like a year or maybe 2 years at most. This is something that, like, this was a war that I was in for 28 years being an officer. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and, you know,
well, a lot that we go through. It's a lot that we have to see, and, yeah, it's...
people need to understand that and remember that when they have interactions with officers, you know?
Exactly. Oh, yeah.
They've been through some stuff, so if they're cranky, it might not just be you that they're cranky at, that they could be dealing with something else.
That is very true. That is very true.
And it's unfortunate.
There is a lot of trauma we deal with in our jobs. But one of the ways that I've gotten by is, well, number one is my faith. I have a very strong faith, but humor.
Yes.
And law enforcement officers, not just me, but a lot of law enforcement officers, we like to use humor.
Yes, gallows humor.
Oh, man. And when people read my book, I couldn't help it, but put humor in it. Why? Because it's a huge part of being a cop. It's what helps us you know, get through some of these traumatic things that we're seeing and dealing with. So helps us get
I'm looking forward to reading it. You've sold me on it.
Well, good. Yes, I'm hoping that everybody will enjoy it. It is a book that people are gonna learn a lot from reading it. I go through a lot of the procedural things that officers do and why we do it, because there's a lot of questions that the general public doesn't understand. Well, why is this officer doing this, or why does an officer do it that way? I explain that because I want people to know why we're doing what we're doing.
Yeah, and that brings up what my last real question for you. You were talking about you had to get a search warrant to search the house.
Yes.
I understand it was a crime scene. Is that because you can't search any area outside of that actual crime scene that you had to go get the warrant?
I had to go get the warrant because if I'm going to collect any evidence whatsoever from the scene, I have to do it properly, and it has to be done through a search warrant. If I don't get a search warrant for a scene and collect the evidence properly, basically anything I collected could be thrown out by a defense attorney. Could be thrown out. Yeah, it's basically the reason why I do it is proper procedure.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Yeah, that stuck in my head when you're talking about it, thinking I've never heard of a search warrant on a crime scene, really.
Oh, it's the golden rule. I mean, it's standard on all crime scenes that I've investigated. It's always best to get a search warrant because any evidence you obtain is locked in. It can't be thrown out of court. I mean, it's almost impossible to get thrown off it. But if you don't have a search warrant, it gives any defense attorney great ammunition against you in a case. They can argue anything, any evidence you found, to get thrown out.
Okay.
And just so happens, by the way that this case was investigated, we did not lose any evidence in this case during the omnibus hearing at all. All evidence was kept in. So yeah, it turned out the investigation went very well.
That is impressive. That's usually, I know oftentimes you'll have evidence gets tossed out, or, you know, so All right, well, we are just about at our time. I'd like to thank you so much for coming on the show. Real quick, where can people find you on social media, Jeremy?
Sure. So, like I mentioned earlier, my book is called Murder on Elm Street, a true life crime story. It'll be coming out on Amazon, and that will be in September of 2023, this coming fall. And you can find me on Facebook also, and under Murder on Elm Street, a true life crime story. And you can also reach me on my email also if you have questions, which is murderonelmstreet@gmail.com.
All right. Well, again, I thank you so much for coming on, Jeremy. Again, the book is Murder on Elm Street, a true life crime story by Jeremy L. Luberts. That's Luberts.
We are at the end of the episode for this week. I want to once again thank our guest, Jeremy Luberts. Please don't forget to click on the links in the show notes. Support our advertisers who support this show and keep me doing this. Until next week, The Deathcast is a co-production of Corpse Creek Publishing in association with Big Pond Podcasts. Stay morbid!